Chapter 10. I just adore it. Do you like candles? Apostrophe, I regard them as an absolute necessity. Are you fond of them? Apostrophe, her eyes fairly danced, and she exclaimed, Oh, don't mention it. Candles. And soap. Apostrophe, and fish interiors. Apostrophe, and train oil. Apostrophe, and slush. Apostrophe, and whale blubber. Apostrophe, and carrion. And sauerkraut. And beeswax. And tar. And turpentine. And molasses. And, apostrophe, don't, oh, don't, I shall expire with ecstasy. Apostrophe, and then serve it all up in a slush bucket, and invite the neighbors and sail in. Apostrophe, apostrophe, but this vision of an ideal feast was too much for her, and she swooned away, poor thing. I rubbed snow in her face, and brought her to, and after a while got her excitement cooled down. By and by she drifted into her story again. So we began to live here in the fine house. But I was not happy. The reason was this. I was born for love. For me there could be no true happiness without it. I wanted to be loved for myself alone. I wanted an idol, and I wanted to be my idol's idol. Nothing less than mutual idolatry would satisfy my fervent nature. I had suitors in plenty and over plenty, indeed, but in each and every case they had a fatal defect. Sooner or later I discovered that defect, not one of them failed to betray it. It was not me they wanted, but my wealth. Apostrophe, apostrophe, your wealth? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes. For my father is much the richest man in this tribe or in any tribe in these regions. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I wondered what her father's wealth consisted of. It couldn't be the house anybody could build its mate. It couldn't be the furs, they were not valued. It couldn't be the sledge, the dogs, the harpoons, the boat, the bonefish hooks and needles, and such things. No, these were not wealth. Then what could it be that made this man so rich, and brought this swarm of sordid suitors to his house? It seemed to me, finally, that the best way to find out would be to ask. So I did it. The girl was so manifestly gratified by the question that I saw as he had been aching to have me ask it. She was suffering fully as much to tell as I was to know. She snuggled confidentially up to me and said, Guess how much he is worth, you never can. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I pretended to consider the matter deeply, she watching my anxious and laboring countenance with a devouring and delighted interest. And when, at last, I gave it up, and begged her to appease my longing, by telling me herself, how much this polar Vanderbilt was worth, she put her mouth close to my ear and whispered, impressively, 22 fish hooks, not bone, but foreign, made out of real iron. Apostrophe, apostrophe, then she sprang back dramatically, to observe the effect. I did my level best not to disappoint her. I turned pale and murmured, Great Scott! Apostrophe, apostrophe, it's as true as you live, Mr. Twain. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Laska, you are deceiving me, you cannot mean it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she was frightened and troubled. She exclaimed, Apostrophe, Mr. Twain, every word of it is true, every word. You believe me, you do believe me, now don't you? Say you believe me, do say you believe me. Apostrophe, I, well, yes, I do, I am trying to. But it was all so sudden. So sudden and prostrating. You shouldn't do such a thing in that sudden way. It, apostrophe, oh, I'm so sorry. If I had only thought, apostrophe, well, it's all right, and I don't blame you anymore, for you are young and thoughtless, and of course you couldn't foresee what an effect, apostrophe, but oh, dear, I ought certainly to have known better. Why, apostrophe, you see, Laska, if you had set 5 or 6 hooks, to start with, and then gradually, apostrophe, oh, I see, then gradually added 1, and then 2, and then, ah, why couldn't I have thought of that? Apostrophe, apostrophe, never mind, child, it's all right, I am better now, I shall be over it in a little while. But to spring the whole 22 on a person unprepared, and not very strong anyway, apostrophe, oh, it was a crime. But you forgive me, say you forgive me. Do. Apostrophe, after harvesting a good deal of very pleasant coaxing and petting and persuading, I forgave her, and she was happy again, and by she got underway with her narrative once more. I presently discovered that the family treasury contained still another feature, a jewel of some sort, apparently, and that she was trying to get around speaking squarely about it, lest I get paralyzed again. But I wanted to know about that thing too, and urged her to tell me what it was. She was afraid. But I insisted, and said I would brace myself this time and be prepared, then the shock would not hurt me. She was full of misgivings, but the temptation to reveal that marvel to me, and enjoy my astonishment and admiration was too strong for her, and she confessed that she had it on her person, and said that, if I was sure I was prepared, and so on, and with that she reached into her bosom, and brought out a battered square of brass, watching my eye anxiously the while. I fell over against her in a quite well-acted feint, which delighted her heart and nearly frightened it out of her too, at the same time. When I came to and got calm, she was eager to know what I thought of her jewel. What do I think of it? I think it is the most exquisite thing I ever saw. Apostrophe, apostrophe, do you really? How nice of you to say that. But it is a love, now isn't it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, I should say so. I'd rather own it than the equator. Apostrophe, I thought you would admire it, apostrophe, she said. I think it is so lovely. And there isn't another one in all these latitudes. People have come all the way from the open polar sea to look at it. Did you ever see one before? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I said no, this was the first one I had ever seen. It cost me a pang to tell that generous lie, for I had seen a million of them in my time, this humble jewel of hers being nothing but a battered old New York Central baggage check. Land. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said I, you don't go about with it on your person this way, alone and with no protection, not even a dog? Apostrophe, apostrophe, SSH, not so loud, apostrophe, she said. Nobody knows I carry it with me. They think it is in Papa's treasury. That is where it generally is. Apostrophe, where is the treasury? Apostrophe, apostrophe, it was a blunt question, and for a moment she looked startled, and a little suspicious, but I said, oh, come, don't you be afraid about me. At home we have 70 millions of people, and although I say it myself that shouldn't, there is not one person among them all but would trust me with untold fish hooks. Apostrophe, apostrophe, this reassured her, and she told me where the hooks were hidden in the house. Then she wandered from her course to brag a little about the size of the sheets of transparent ice that formed the windows of the mansion, and asked me if I had ever seen their like at home, and I came right out frankly, and confessed that I hadn't, which pleased her more than she could find words to dress her gratification in. It was so easy to please her, and such a pleasure to do it, that I went on and said, ah, Laska, you are a fortune girl. This beautiful house, this dainty jewel, that rich treasure, all this elegant snow, and sumptuous icebergs and limitless sterility, and public bears and walruses, and noble freedom and largeness and everybody's admiring eyes upon you, and everybody's homage and respect at your command without the asking, young, rich, beautiful, sought, courted, envied, not a requirement unsatisfied, not a desire ungratified. Nothing to wish for, that you cannot have, it is immeasurable good fortune. I have seen myriads of girls, but none of whom these extraordinary things could be truthfully said but you alone. And you are worthy, worthy of it all, Laska, I believe it in my heart. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it made her infinitely proud and happy to hear me say this, and she thanked me over and over again for that closing remark, and her voice and eyes showed that she was touched. Presently she said, still, it is not all sunshine, there is a cloudy side. The burden of wealth is a heavy one to bear. Sometimes I have doubted if it were not better to be poor, at least not inordinately rich. It pains me to see neighboring tribesmen stare as they pass by, and overhear them say, reverently, one to another, "There, that is she, the millionaire's daughter." And sometimes they say sorrowfully, "She is rolling in fish hooks, and I have nothing." It breaks my heart. When I was a child and we were poor, we slept with the door open, if we chose, but now we have to have a night watchman. In those days my father was gentle and courteous to all, but now he is austere and haughty and cannot abide familiarity. Once his family were his sole thought, but now he goes about thinking of his fish hooks all the time. And his wealth makes everybody cringing and obsequious to him. Formerly nobody laughed at his jokes, they being always stale and far-fetched and poor, and destitute of the one element that can really justify a joke, the element of humor. But now everybody laughs and cackles at these dismal things, and if any fails to do it, my father is deeply displeased, and shows it. Formerly his opinion was not sought upon any matter, and was not valuable when he volunteered it. It has that infirmity yet, but, nevertheless, it is sought by all and applauded by all, and he helps, duly applauding himself, having no true delicacy and a plentiful want of tact. He has lowered the tone of all our tribe. Once they were a frank and manly race, now they are measly hypocrites, and sodden with servility. In my heart of hearts I hate all the ways of millionaires. Our tribe was once plain simple folk, and content with the bonefish hooks of their fathers. Now they are eaten up with avarice, and would sacrifice every sentiment of honor and honesty to possess themselves of the debasing iron fish hooks of the foreigner. However, I must not dwell on these sad things. As I have said, it was my dream to be loved for myself alone. At last, this dream seemed about to be fulfilled. A stranger came by, one day, who said his name was Kalila. I told him my name, and he said he loved me. My heart gave a great bound of gratitude and pleasure, for I had loved him at sight, and now I said so. He took me to his breast, and said he would not wish to be happier than he was now. We went strolling together far over the ice floes, telling all about each other, and planning, oh, the loveliest future. When we were tired at last we sat down and ate, for he had soap and candles and I had brought along some blubber. We were hungry, and nothing was ever so good. He belonged to a tribe whose haunts were far to the north, and I found that he had never heard of my father, which rejoiced me exceedingly. I mean he had heard of the millionaire, but had never heard his name, so, you see, he could not know that I was the heiress. You may be sure that I did not tell him. I was loved for myself at last, and was satisfied. I was so happy, oh, happier than you can think. By and by it was towards supper time, and I led him home. As we approached our house he was amazed, and cried out, "How splendid! Is that your father's?" It gave me a pang to hear that tone, and see that admiring light in his eye, but the feeling quickly passed away, for I loved him so, and he looked so handsome and noble. All my family of aunts and uncles and cousins were pleased with him, and many guests were called in, and the house was shut up tight and the rag lamps lighted, and when everything was hot and comfortable and suffocating, we began a joyous feast in celebration of my betrothal. When the feast was over my father's vanity overcame him, and he could not resist the temptation to show off his riches, and let Kalila see what grand good fortune he had stumbled into, and mainly, of course, he wanted to enjoy the poor man's amazement. I could have cried, but it would have done no good to try to dissuade my father, so I said nothing, but merely sat there and suffered. My father went straight to the hiding place in full sight of everybody, and got out the fish hooks, and brought them, and flung them scatteringly over my head, so that they fell in glittering confusion on the platform at my lover's knee. Of course, the astounding spectacle took the poor lad's breath away. He could only stare in stupid astonishment, and wonder how a single individual could possess such incredible riches. Then presently he glanced brilliantly up and exclaimed, "Ah, it is you who are the renowned millionaire!" My father and all the rest burst into shouts of happy laughter, and when my father gathered the treasure carelessly up, as if it might be mere rubbish, and of no consequence, and carried it back to its place, poor Kulala's surprise was a study. He said, "Is it possible that you put such things away without counting them?" My father delivered a vainglorious hoarse laugh, and said, "Well, truly, a body may know you have never been rich, since a mere matter of a fish hook or two is such a mighty matter in your eyes." Kalila was confused, and hung his head, but said, "Ah, indeed, sir, I was never worth the value of the barb of one of those precious things, and I have never seen any man before who was so rich in them, as to render the counting of his hoard worthwhile, since the wealthiest man I have ever known, till now, was possessed of but three." My foolish father roared again with genuine delight, and allowed the impression to remain, that he was not accustomed to count his hooks and keep sharp watch over them. He was showing off, you see. Count them? Why, he counted them every day. I had met, and got acquainted with my darling just at dawn. I had brought him home just at dark, 3 hours afterwards, for the days were shortening toward the 6 months' night at that time. We kept up the festivities many hours. Then, at last, the guests departed and the rest of us distributed ourselves along the walls on sleeping benches, and soon all were steeped in dreams but me. I was too happy, too excited, to sleep. After I had lain quiet a long, long time, a dim form passed by me, and was swallowed up in the gloom that pervaded the farther end of the house. I could not make out who it was, or whether it was man or woman. Presently that figure or another one passed me going the other way. I wondered what it all meant, but wondering did no good. And while I was still wondering I fell asleep. I do not know how long I slept, but at last I came suddenly broad awake, and heard my father say in a terrible voice, "By the great snow god, there's a fish hook gone." Something told me that that meant sorrow for me, and the blood in my veins turned cold. The presentiment was confirmed in the same instant. My father shouted, "Up, everybody, and seize the stranger." Then there was an outburst of cries and curses from all sides, and a wild rush of dim forms through the obscurity. I flew to my beloved's help, but what could I do but wait and wring my hands? He was already fenced away from me by a living wall, he was being bound and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.